welcome to the latest edition of the RBC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name's Mark Cleesby, and today I'm talking with Chris Lamb, a member of the RVC's Department of Veterinary Clinical Studies and a radiologist, about his recent studies into the importance of using new imaging modalities such as MRI and CT in the investigation of disease in small animals. So Chris, thanks very much for joining us today. I wonder, you've been a lecturer at the RVC now since 1992, and I wonder if you could start off by telling us what sort of changes you've seen in the imaging modalities available in veterinary practice during that time.
Basically, there's been a marked increase in the complexity of imaging techniques and the choices that are available to practitioners and their clients. So that if we go back, let's say, 30 years, vets were predominantly making radiographs on film, which is pretty familiar to most people. And then from the late 80s onwards, veterinary schools in the UK and practices to an increasing degree bought ultrasound machines. Mm-hmm. In the 90s, ultrasound became very common in veterinary medicine and is a very useful modality because it's relatively inexpensive, it's quite versatile, and it's had a big impact on vets' abilities to diagnose and manage cardiac and a range of abdominal conditions in dogs and cats.
Yeah.
In the last 10 years, MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, and CT, computed tomography or CAT scan, has become established in the veterinary schools and subsequently a number of referral practices around the country have got into CT and MRI. So there's a lot more choice, as I say, available to vets at referral practices than there used to be.
Okay, so CT and MRI are something that most practitioners could at least indirectly access these days.
That's right.
What are the cost factors involved in performing these techniques then?
The equipment necessary for CT and MRI is big, heavy, fixed, complicated. And so to add CT or MRI to your practice involves usually an extension to the building, a custom-built extension to the building, and then installation of a piece of equipment that could cost anything from, let's say, £100,000 to £500,000 mm-hmm. for the installation and the purchase. And then the running costs can be very considerable. It's usual to have a service contract that covers the cost of maintaining this equipment and dealing with any faults that might crop up. And a service contract for a CT scanner or an MR scanner could quite easily be £60,000 a year.
Right.
So the costs are quite considerable.
Okay, and obviously they have to be recouped in a commercial environment too.
Absolutely. So it's generally referral practices that have a large proportion of their patients with relatively demanding or complicated problems mm-hmm. that will benefit from these modalities. That you couldn't, in a typical first opinion small animal practice, you simply wouldn't have enough cases that, for example, would be suitable for MRI to make it cost effective.
Okay. Now, your colleague Pete Mantis in an earlier podcast talked quite a great detail about MRI and some of the technical features and basis of that. But perhaps just as an introduction to MRI and CT, you could just tell us very briefly what the principles of each are.
Yes, CT is a technique that's based on firing X-rays through the patient from an X-ray tube that rotates around them so that X-rays pass through the patient at a wide range of angles, and the X-rays that emerge on the far side of the patient are collected by a large number of small electronic detectors, and the signals that come from the X-rays are sent to a computer that can analyse the data and then recreate images of that represent cross sections of the body, and within the cross section of the body, the image will show the different structures according to how much they absorb X-rays.
Mm-hmm.
So bones, for example, will look relatively white on a CT image because they absorb a lot of X-rays, whereas the lung will look virtually black because it absorbs very few. And then other tissues, muscle, the various parenchymal organs, body fat, will be intermediate. There'll be different shades of grey. So CT is a brilliant way of getting anatomical information about the body and being able to see structures in some detail in cross-sectional images.
Ultimately, it's a sort of sophisticated X-ray.
It is a sophisticated X-ray, and compared to a conventional radiograph, in which the image always represents the full thickness of the patient, the CT scan represents a slice through the patient, and it eliminates the problem of superimposition that makes interpreting radiographs so difficult. Superimposition is eliminated by CT, and this means that we can see, in general, structures much more clearly.
And MRI is very different?
It is, and that's one of the benefits of it. It's got nothing to do with X-rays. It's everything to do with magnetism. Basically, if you take a patient and you put them in a very strong magnetic field, it affects many of the atoms in their body, and they align with the magnetic field. What you can then do is you can alter the magnetic field around the patient so that you literally change the orientation of many of the atoms. Having done that, you release the magnetism so that the atoms can relax or return to their resting state. And interestingly, as they do that, they emit radio frequency radiation. In other words, radio waves.
Yeah.
And part of the MRI scanner is a radio receiver that's literally tuned in to the frequency of the atoms in the body. So that it's possible to detect signals in the body that come from changing orientation of these atoms. Having done that, again, there's a relatively sophisticated computer that can analyse the signals and then make images representing, like CT, cross sections through the body. The difference between an MR image and a CT image is that, because the physical basis of the image is completely different, the types of structures that are best depicted are quite different as well.
Right.
So a CT scan, let's say, of the brain would not produce a lot of detail because the grey and the white matter, for example, are so very similar in their X-ray attenuation. Mm-hmm. But in an MR image, it's possible to make a very clear difference between the white and the grey matter because the atoms within those structures behave quite differently when they're in the magnetic field. And what we find is that there are many parts of the body that are well suited to CT. So, for example, the lung or bones are very well depicted on CT. But the brain and spinal cord, for example, are, we think, much better depicted on an MR image.
Okay, so that was the next question, really, is what sort of diagnoses is one looking to make with each of these techniques in general at the moment?
I think that for CT, the major applications in our practice are in the head. We examine dogs and cats with nasal disease because we can make very detailed images of the nasal cavity.
Mm-hmm.
Animals that have been traumatized, car accidents with head injuries or spine injuries, are good candidates for CT. We can generally recognize fractures very well and damage to soft tissues. The thorax, in other words, the lungs, are also beautifully depicted in CT images, and we frequently find that we can see abnormalities in the lung much more clearly using CT than we can with conventional radiographs. In humans, CT is used a lot in the abdomen, but less so in veterinary medicine. In contrast, the most popular application for MRI in veterinary medicine is neurological.
Right.
So dogs and cats with conditions affecting the brain and the spine are the bulk of our caseload at the RVC. And I think that's probably true in most referral practices, although MR can also be used to look at other structures such as the abdomen, joints. And it's probably fair to say that practices that don't have a CT scanner may use their MRI scanner for a greater number of applications than we do at the RVC.
Mm-hmm. You have access to both, obviously.
We have access to both, yes.
So this increasing availability of MRI and CT then is must be a beneficial thing in terms of being able to diagnose a lot of conditions more easily.
I think it is good. Again, it gives vets more choices, increases their capabilities. But there are always costs or downsides associated with this increased choice. For example, these techniques aren't necessarily very easy to use, and so there's a need to develop expertise in making the images and interpreting the images. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily very easy or straightforward to do, so that one can't always be confident that these techniques are being used optimally, because we're all, to some extent, learning how to get the best out of them. Another problem is the cost to the client, because these techniques, as we were saying, they're expensive to install and maintain, and because of that, the unit cost for a scan will be generally several hundred pounds, or in some referral practices, the cost of an MRI scan to the client could exceed £1,000.
Right.
So this is a considerable amount of money, and you have to ask the question, is the patient going to experience a significant benefit as a result of that additional cost? It's a question that's very easy to ask, and I think it's important that we do ask it. It's not necessarily very easy to answer. There are very few sources of information out there about veterinary medicine that will help us to answer these questions.
Okay, so you've actually then undertaken a couple of studies looking at this problem with specific examples. One of these was on elbow dysplasia and techniques for diagnosing this and what benefits these techniques may have longer term in terms of outcome. So perhaps you could just give us a quick introduction to what elbow dysplasia is in dogs.
Yeah, elbow dysplasia. Well, the short answer is it's an awful term.
Right.
It's been described as a dustbin term into which people drop all the various conditions that can affect the canine elbow. Depending on the breed and the age and so on, there are a range of conditions that can cause elbow lameness in dogs. And elbow dysplasia is a term that is used just to lump these together. Personally, I find it very unsatisfactory. I'm much more interested in splitting up and distinguishing between the different causes of elbow lameness in dogs, because the etiology and the treatment and the prognosis will be very different depending on what we're speaking about. One of the commonest of the elbow conditions that forms part of this syndrome, elbow dysplasia, is called fragmentation of the medial coronoid process. And in this condition, which is very well recognised in young Labradors and young Rottweilers especially, there tends to be some kind of damage in the articular cartilage on the medial coronoid process of the ulna. And this damage to the cartilage can cause pain and can set up secondary inflammatory changes in the joint. And we like to be able to detect this lesion so that we can select animals that can go to surgery, either arthrotomy or arthroscopy, and have this damaged cartilage removed, basically.
Before it gets into chronic inflammatory.
That's problems. Right. The aim is to treat these animals at an early age, because if the arthritis becomes established, then it's virtually impossible to turn the clock back. If you can treat them earlier, then the idea is that you can minimise the long-term damage to the joint and maximise the dog's use of the joint, quality of life, basically.
Okay, so what then are the diagnostic modalities that you've looked at specifically for this condition?
We concentrated on CT. We went through a period of time where we routinely would do a CT scan of both elbows of dogs with suspected fragmentation of the medial coronal process. And we did that so that we could try and identify which joints should be explored surgically. Mm-hmm. What we found was that although there are many animals in which the CT shows us there's damage to the joint, the association between what we see on the CT image and what the surgeon subsequently found wasn't particularly close. And at first glance, that might seem surprising, but actually it's quite logical. The CT scan shows us in some detail the bone that forms the elbow, the humerus, the radius, and the ulna. Uh-huh. We can see these bones, we can look at their edges and the density of the bone. And very often there'll be abnormalities that are visible affecting the bone that enable us to deduce what's wrong with the joint. But what we see in the CT image doesn't necessarily correlate exactly with what the surgeon sees, because when a surgeon does arthroscopy, they don't see the bone at all. What they see is the articular cartilage over the surface of the bone.
Yeah.
And abnormalities affecting the cartilage will not always occur in association with abnormalities affecting the bone. So we could, for example, see some variations in the density of the bone and think that that's important. But then the arthroscopist might see that the articular cartilage over the surface of the bone is intact and smooth and normal. On the other hand, we might CT an elbow and the bone looks normal, but when the arthroscopist gets in, they see that there's some superficial damage to the cartilage. It may be roughened or cracked, or there may be some loose fragment that they need to remove that wasn't evident on the CT scan.
Right, and they're going to deal with that as they find it by arthroscopy in terms of debriding and so on.
That's right. It's a very interesting question. Which is the most important abnormality? That affecting the subchondral bone, the bone beneath the cartilage, or the cartilaginous lesion? I think that the weight of evidence suggests that the cartilage lesion is the most important, and that's what the arthroscopist is there to treat. So you're quite right.
In this situation, when one encounters, for example, a sort of youngish Labrador that's been limping on a forelimb for a few weeks in practice, what would you say that you are going to do now on the basis of this study?
Okay, if you really have a dog that, on the basis of the type of dog, its age and the clinical signs, seems very likely to have fragmentation of the medial coronoid process, so it's a young Labrador or Rottweiler, as we were saying before, my recommendation would be to take it to arthroscopy and to do a more or less definitive examination of the articular cartilage, and if there's a lesion, to debride it or remove the fragment. I think that for the majority of animals, that will be enough because that will enable you to detect the abnormality and to treat it. And that would probably be the end of the surgical treatment for a patient like that. And debatably, no further imaging would be necessary.
Right.
If one were to work the other way around, you could easily envisage the situation where you do CT scans of elbows, and whether or not you see signs of fragmentation on the CT scan, you would still be obliged to take the animal to arthroscopy.
Yes, so you're not missing...
That's right. We're not confident enough
yeah.
in the CT findings to be able to say to our surgeon colleague, it's unnecessary to explore that joint. Now, if we're not able to select for them the joints that should and should not have arthroscopy, then the impact of the CT on the management of the case is very minimal.
Mm.
And so I think that one could actually envisage working the opposite way around to the way we have been working. So instead of repeatedly doing or routinely doing CT scans and then going to arthroscopy, I think that for these dogs with the classic syndrome, they could go to arthroscopy, and we could reserve the CT for the relatively small proportion of them in which the arthroscopic findings reveal something unexpected.
Yeah.
Or the animal doesn't respond well to the arthroscopic treatment and we suspect there might be some other problem. That would mean that we were using the CT in a more selective way.
Okay. And therefore, obviously, you know, potentially saving money if it wasn't necessary.
That's exactly right.
I guess, I mean, just to sort of complete this, you presumably still start off with plain x-rays of the joint before you went to arthroscopy, but...
That's true. Mm. In a referral practice like ours, it's usual for the referring vet
sure.
to have made some radiographs of the joint, and that's a good idea as a first step. And there are many conditions, not fragmented medial coronoid process usually, but there are some other elbow conditions that are identifiable on survey radiographs.
Yeah.
Ununited anconeal process would be one.
Mm-hmm.
And once that's been seen on the radiograph, again, no further imaging would be necessary.
Right, okay. So that's the elbows. And the other thing that you had a look at in a separate study was spinal cord conditions. Now, how would one normally demonstrate these in a practice setting if one encounters a dog with back pain or paresis?
Okay. Well, this is a pretty common scenario, I think, for practitioners. Of the various injuries that can affect the spinal cord, a slip disc is relatively common in dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And when that's suspected, the usual first line approach would be to make some radiographs of the spine. And although they're not perfect, in many animals with a slip disc, we can identify signs that would lead us to that diagnosis. In animals where the diagnosis remains uncertain, the next step, traditionally, is myelography.
Uh-huh.
So this would involve injection of a contrast medium that shows up white on a radiograph into the fluid-filled space around the spinal cord. This enables us to see the spinal cord and to identify anything that's pressing on it or causing swelling of the cord.
Right.
Because lesions that do that will cause some deviation in the fluid around the cord, and we can see that using a myelogram.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes myelography is technically a bit difficult because placing the needle to inject the contrast medium right next to the spinal cord can be tricky. It depends on the size and shape of the dog
yeah.
and whether it has any other spinal conditions. Some dogs, for example, have quite a stiff spine, and it's rather difficult to get them into a suitable position to place the needle. Having done that, it's sometimes difficult to interpret myelograms, because the tendency is for lesions that press on the spinal cord or make the spinal cord swell to prevent the contrast medium from spreading. And so this is not what you'd really want. In an ideal world, you'd like to inject the contrast medium and have it accumulate at the lesion, so it's very easy to see the lesion. But with myelography, the opposite tends to happen. If there's a lesion, it occurs at the place where there's the least contrast medium. Now, this can make it rather difficult to see.
Yes.
We're forever looking at the contrast medium at the point where it fades away to decide, is it displaced in this direction, is it displaced in that direction, so we get a feel for the type of lesion. So it can be a difficult study to do, and it can be a difficult study to interpret. And I think many first opinion vets might be hesitant to attempt myelography for that reason.
Yes, it's a bit subjective then in the end.
Potentially it is, yeah.
Okay. So what are the advantages then, or potential advantages, in using MRI to add to this as a diagnostic technique?
I don't think there's any doubt that compared to myelography, which only shows us the fluid-filled space around the spinal cord, MRI is, well, spectacular, really. It enables us to see all the different components of the spine of a dog. We can see the spinal cord itself, and we can see the fluid-filled space around it.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, we can see the vertebral canal and the bones that form the vertebral canal, and even the muscles and some of the ligaments that connect those bones. So it's a very complete anatomical depiction,
right,
of the anatomy. And one would imagine that it'd be much more useful for that reason.
So if you're getting a much better picture with your MRI than potentially with myelography, does that imply, therefore, that using MRI gives you a much better outcome in these dogs?
One would expect so, but that isn't necessarily the case. What we did was we studied animals that we'd seen over a period of several years, during which time MRI was only available on a Wednesday and a Friday at the college, because it was a mobile MRI and it came on a big truck.
Right.
And if a dog came to us with an acute spinal problem on a Wednesday or a Friday, the neurologists were very keen to get an MRI as soon as possible, within a few hours of the animal arriving at the hospital. But if a dog came with the same presenting signs on any other day of the week when MRI wasn't available, then it went to myelography.
Mm-hmm.
Again, they would do that very promptly, within a few hours of the animal arriving, because our belief is that very prompt treatment of spinal cord injuries to relieve any compression on the spinal cord is one of the most important things that you can do to improve the patient.
Yeah.
So we have this period of time during which animals with the same basic presenting signs either went to MRI or went to myelography, depending on the day of the week that they came to us. Now, that's not a randomization, but it's nevertheless a way of creating two different groups that we can compare.
Uh-huh.
One group of dogs with spinal conditions that went to MRI, and another group of dogs, very similar presenting signs, that went to myelography. And so what we were able to do was to compare these two groups, and we looked at a variety of outcomes. So we looked at how long they spent in the hospital. We looked at the total bill, total cost of hospitalisation.
Right.
We looked at what proportion of these animals were treated surgically or medically, what proportion survived their spinal cord injury. We compared the mortalities. And what we found was that there were very few differences between the dogs that had gone to myelography and the dogs that had MRI. We didn't recognise that the dogs that went to MRI did any better.
Okay.
One would expect that if the MRI images were so much better than the myelograms that our surgeons were better able to detect the abnormality and to do a very accurate surgery to relieve it, that would in turn lead to an improved outcome for the dog. And we would recognise an improved outcome, very likely, in that the hospitalisation period would be less.
Yeah.
So when an animal comes in with an acute spinal cord injury and gets a treatment within a few hours, there's a period of time during which it gradually recovers, and then there comes a point where it can go home. The quicker an animal recovers would be one of the ways that you might recognise an improved treatment. And if the MRI enabled our surgeons to do an improved surgical treatment, we would have expected the hospitalisation to be shorter. But it wasn't.
Right.
In fact, it was slightly longer for the MRI. Well, the difference wasn't significant. The significant differences we found between the dogs that had myelography and had MRI were only that the dogs that had MRI had a bigger bill when they went home. It was, on average, £660 greater than the dogs that had myelography. And I don't want to be cynical, but I think that's the sort of outcome that one might have imagined. Myelography is imperfect, but it's still extremely useful. MRI is a spectacularly good method of imaging the spine, but it'll often show us structures that aren't affected. It may be that myelography shows us the critical structures well enough that there's no advantage to the MRI.
So, I mean, perhaps then you're implying that you can be slightly distracted by the level of detail you get on the MRI, whereas the myelography may be slightly more specific for the lesions that one is actually looking for.
I would hope that people aren't necessarily distracted by the amount of information in an MR image. I don't think that most radiologists would be concerned about that. I think most radiologists would prefer to see an MR image because they want to feel they're doing a more complete examination.
Yes.
But I suppose the point is that the myelogram, although it's a very specific examination that just shows us the fluid-filled space around the cord, from the point of view of animals that go for surgery, that is the critical feature. It's simpler, but it's still very relevant. And what we find is that some of the animals that have an MRI scan have abnormalities, perhaps affecting the spinal cord itself. But those abnormalities could have been predicted anyway on the basis of the animal's clinical signs.
Uh-huh.
And those abnormalities aren't necessarily treated surgically. They may be treated just with rest,
yeah,
because they tend to recover on their own. So some of the conditions, and actually I'm speaking about something called fibrocartilaginous embolism, some of these conditions that are depicted by the MRI can be treated satisfactorily whether you have an MRI image or not.
Okay, so in a practice situation then, I mean, what would be your recommendation at this stage? If one has expertise in doing myelography, then clearly one should go for that and then assess whether a decompressive surgery is indicated there or elsewhere.
That's an interesting question, is that I think that if I said to my neurology colleagues about any specific patient, don't bother going to MRI, we'll do a myelogram on this one, I don't think they'd be very happy,
right,
to follow my recommendation. I think the tendency is that if you've got MRI, you're always going to want to use it because of the possibility that it will show you more and what it shows you is relevant. I think the conclusion I would draw from this study is for those people who don't have access to MRI, don't necessarily feel that you're working in a substandard environment. if you're able to do a myelogram, that remains a perfectly reasonable option for investigating a dog with an acute spinal cord injury.
Okay, and there's no absolute necessity then for them to obviously bust them off elsewhere to get an MRI, presumably at the cost of time and money.
I think that's a very good point, yes.
Okay, so I guess what I finish with then is just to sort of ask briefly in the light of this, what would you say, as someone with access to both of these techniques, are the key diseases that you will always go for with CT and MRI?
With CT, I think that it's a very versatile technique, and I think if you are working in a practice where you see respiratory tract disease, head and spine trauma, you see animals with tumours that need treatment by surgery or by radiation therapy, then CT is very well suited to those patients. I think that only practices that have a high neurology caseload would get the full benefit from MRI at the moment. So if somebody were ever to ask me, I have a busy general practice and I have money to invest in advanced diagnostic imaging, should I go for a CT or an MRI? I think my initial response would be that CT is likely to be the first choice. It's particularly versatile. Technically, it's a less complex modality than MRI. I think it's easier to learn. The images are sometimes easier to interpret.
Sure.
And it's cheaper.
And in the light of the studies you've undertaken, I mean, are you pursuing a similar avenue? Are there other areas or specific examples of comparisons between techniques that you think are warranted at the moment?
I'm sure there are. I think that looking to quantify the benefits of advanced imaging is something that we should be doing more of. As we've been discussing, we've done a couple of studies with CT and with MR. I think there's a number of studies that we could do looking at the diagnostic impact of ultrasonography. That's less new, less advanced, less sexy than CT and MRI. But in terms of imaging across the country, is very, very widely used.
Uh-huh.
And I think there's more we could do to better understand the potential benefit of ultrasonography in dogs and cats with a variety of abdominal conditions. Do animals with suspected renal failure benefit from ultrasonography? Do animals with immune-mediated anemias benefit from ultrasonography? Do young dogs with chronic gastrointestinal complaints benefit from ultrasonography? I suspect that the answer to each of those questions will be no.
Right.
But we would rather find out rather than assume that.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a very interesting topic for our next podcast then. Thank you very much indeed, Chris, for a very illuminating discussion, which I think was of great relevance to the people out there at the coalface in practice.
I hope so. Thanks very much.
And thank you once again for listening to the latest edition of the RBC podcast. As ever, if you have any comments or suggestions with regard to the podcast, feel free to email us at podcast@rbc.ac.uk. And I hope very much you'll be able to join us again next time. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.